This morning we continue in Hebrews, and that's what we're planning on doing this morning, is to cover the first four verses of Hebrews chapter 12. We've just finished with Hebrews chapter 11, where the author is trying to get his recipients to see the big picture. He is bringing one covenant saint after the other forward to them to show how they endured persecution, how they endured all kinds of trials. And he understands that they are going through a rough time now. There is much pressure on them to leave the Christian faith and to go back to the Judaism that they had just come out of. They were being persecuted. And in fact, as we're going to see today, the persecution might end up in martyrdom. He ended up last week, however, he states at the end of Hebrews chapter 10, he makes this statement, Hebrews chapter 11 rather, he said, all these, talking about the old covenant saints in verse 39, having gained approval through their faith, did not receive what was promised, because God had provided something better for us, so that apart from us, they would not be made perfect. The ultimate promise is Jesus Christ. We're all going to be blessed there together. So we will be glorified together. The old covenant saints and the new covenant saints together will receive the ultimate promise. However, I ended up with a statement by Ligonier Ministries' Robert Rothwell that I think sums this up so well. I'm talking about these recipients. He says, to leave Jesus, therefore, that is going back into the Judaistic faith, would not be to return to the faith of the Old Covenant saints. You wouldn't be going back to their faith. He said, but it would be to join a religion devoid of God's promises and power. Jesus fulfilled Old Testament Judaism. There is no hope for anyone who attempts to walk in the footsteps of the Old Covenant saints, Old Covenant saints, apart from faith in Christ. So you leave Judaism, you leave all these promises. You're not going back to the same faith your forefathers had. You're going back to a different faith. And it's one devoid of the promises. So he has told them about that. And now he's going to be turning to their particular situation this morning at the beginning of Hebrews chapter 12. And we're going to start back there with Steve this morning. If you will read us the first four verses of Hebrews chapter 12.
All right. Wherefore, seeing we also are compassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which doth so easily beset us, and let us run with patience the race that is set before us, looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is set down at the right hand of the throne of God. For consider him that endured such contradiction of sinners against himself. Lest ye be wearied and faint in your minds. Ye have not yet resisted unto blood, striving against sin.
All right. That is the passage we will be looking at. And Charles, if you look up Westminster Shorter Catechism number 26 for us. Okay. Not to read right this minute, but that is coming up. All right, after encouraging the recipients by showing what the Old Covenant saints accomplished by faith, what they accomplished by faith, that is the blank, the author now turns to their situation. He's told all this stuff before. Now he says, therefore, Since we have this great title, it's okay. So it's what he is doing here is painting a picture of an amphitheater. And they are running a race in it. They are running a race in front of this great cloud of witnesses. So he tells them in the first two verses all of these things. There's a lot of stuff packed in here. He says, they have faithful veterans cheering them on. Is that our case? Do we have faithful veterans cheering us on? Do those old covenant saints in heaven know what's going on? And if so, how much? Just something to think about. We won't ever solve that in here this morning. Mm-hmm. I think the book of Revelation shows that in chapter 6, they at least have some sort of knowledge of what's going on in the earth. So they can be, you know, they have a home field advantage, so to speak. They have faithful veterans cheering them on. Okay, then they must run a long race, which requires endurance. This is not a sprint. This is going to be a long race. Third thing, they're going to have to lay aside distractions. The New American Standard says lay aside every encumbrance. Some translations say every weight. I looked it up in a lexicon. Either one of those is a good translation. It would be anything that would hinder them from running a long race. Now, since I have run marathons in my life and I train marathon runners, I've got some good inside information for you guys this morning. When long races, especially marathons, are usually held in the colder months because heat and long races just don't go together. Now, since they're held in the winter months, or close to the winter months, when you line up at the starting line, it's going to be 25 or 30 degrees with some wind most of the time. So most of the runners line up with three or four layers of clothing over their torso. The legs, it doesn't matter. The legs can take it. But on the torso, you have three or four layers. And the outer layers, you want what's called throwaways. When you're 10 miles into the race and you're hot, you want to be able to take something off and just throw it over the side and not even care if you ever see it again. So it's what long-distance runners do in a race. When they start off, it might be 30 degrees. If it's a marathon, it's going to be 12 o'clock or so before you get through. It's going to be 60 degrees. So along the way, you take off outer layers of clothing, the throwaways. It's what they're doing is getting rid of every weight that they don't need. They want to be as light as possible. When they finish the race, they don't want any more clothes on than is what is legally necessary. And back in Rome, it was nothing. But anyway, it's what we have here is an example to bring out the meaning of this. When you're running a long race, you don't want anything impeding you. And so the author of Hebrews is here telling them anything that's going to be an encumbrance to you, extra weight, or in any way impede you in your Christian walk, or run in this case, in your Christian run, you need to get rid of it. You need to be down to the bare essentials. Nothing. You don't see people running races with 10-pound dumbbells in their hands. They want to be as light as possible. That idea is here. Nothing that you don't need. Nothing to encumber you. And it says, and the sin which so easily entangles you. Not every encumbrance is a sin. But every sin would, of course, be an encumbrance. So they're going to have to lay aside all the distractions, and then the next one is they cannot allow themselves to fall into sin. Sin would be worse than an encumbrance. And then they must run the course that is marked out for them. You have to run God's course. When you line up at a starting line to run a race, you don't get to say, oh, I want to go over that way. There's no hills that way. Now, if you want to run the race, it is already marked out for you, and you have to endure through the hard parts. You need to do it God's way. When we run this race, it has to be God's way. You can't run around the hills, so to speak. You've got to run the race that is set before you, the one that is marked out already. But that should be comforting, right? That our race is marked out. God knows what He's doing. If you mark the race out, you would mess it up. And then finally, they must stay focused on Jesus. Jesus ran a much tougher course than we'll ever run. And He was a lot more successful than any of us. So we are to fix our eyes upon Jesus. Okay, the Old Covenant saints walked by faith and endured. However, Jesus, who they have actually focused on, is the author and perfecter of their faith. Or you can put in whatever your translation says. The New American Standard Bible says, the author and perfecter of our faith. And so He's the perfect example. So you want to fix your eyes on Jesus. He endured the cross, along with its shame, by looking ahead, being future-oriented. And we've talked about that before, how we're to look forward to the reward. Just like Jesus did. He looked for the joy that was set before Him. So we are to be future-oriented, looking for the reward. He looked ahead to the joy. And also, consider that Jesus was not a sinner. So He, whatever bad came upon Him, He didn't deserve it. We deserve it. And no matter how bad the course is for us, it's better than what we deserve. So He endured, so He is now sitting at the right hand of God. Now, and now, as promised, He has been given all authority in heaven and on earth. So we have the God-man, Jesus Christ, who has been through everything we have been through and much more, now sitting at the right hand of God with all authority in heaven and on earth. He is bringing us along as our author and perfecter. Okay, and so He is prophet, priest, and king, and we're going to concentrate just a minute on His kingship, which is Westminster Shorter Catechism question and answer number 26, which Charles has for us.
The question asks, how does Christ execute the office of a king? Christ executes the office of a king in subduing us to Himself and ruling and defending us and in restraining and conquering all His and our enemies.
So that's good news for us. We have our king sitting at the right hand of God, ruling over us, conquering all of His and our enemies. And so we have the help we need. God marks the course out for us. God gives us everything we need along the course. When we come to an aid station, we're going to get whatever we need, water or whatever. He is going to provide everything we need. Any comments so far on this, Charles?
I think it's worth considering that when that statement was written about Him being the perfecter of our faith, and as the Catechism points out, you know, ruling and defending us and conquering all His and our enemies, I mean, that's the Catechism, but it's certainly implied in the text. The text was written at a time when the Christians were in a severe minority and horribly persecuted. So that represents a hope and anticipation that they had no reason to believe what would be accomplished based on what they were seeing in front of them. Yep. And depending on how you want to parse this, the conquering of their enemies took place in AD 70 when the temple was destroyed. And the main persecutors at that time were the Jews.
Yeah. Amen.
So, but then, of course, Rome became just as bad or worse, and it too eventually fell and became Christianized. So, I think that's a great word of encouragement for us in this day.
And we need it.
It can be an encouragement because in your Hebrews chapter 10, where, what does it say? Y'all went over that a few weeks ago, I'm sure. It says that, but this man, after he had offered one sacrifice for sins, forever sat down on the right hand of God, from henceforth expecting his enemies to be made his footstool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Our enemies are just the footstool for Christ. Great encouragement. Steve?
This point here about being future-oriented is extremely important because, you know, our whole culture just seems to be present-oriented. You know, it's what they can get out of it right now. And even among Christians, in the various eschatological views, Ken Gentry in his book, Keyshawn of Dominion, points out, you know, the importance that postmillennialism is very future-oriented. Of course, it affects the present very powerfully. But still, with that vision of the future, that you know that's not going to be realized in your lifetime, but you still work towards that with the same kind of faith that we see in these Old Testament saints who did not receive the promise either. But they were living in complete faith, looking forward to that. And in that way, we too are living by faith in the advancement of God's kingdom here on earth.
Okay. Good points for everybody. All right, let's have some lookups here. Elaine, you're next over there. I'll have you look up John 13, 34, and 35. And then Joshua, John 15, 12 through 14.
15, 12 through 14.
Right. And Alanda, 1 John 3, 16 through 18. 1 John 3, 16 and 18.
What did you ask me? John 13, what?
34 and 35. And we'll be getting there in just a minute. Okay, so verse 3 tells us, consider him who has endured such hostility by sinners against himself, so that you will not grow weary and lose heart. That kind of wraps up everything he's been talking about. So the author continues to give them counsel on how to endure. So what they need is endurance, he's told them before. You have need of endurance. So from verses 2 to 4, in those group of three, of that group of three verses, he tells them, of course, to fix their eyes on Jesus. He tells them also to consider Jesus, who has been through more than we will ever go through. And of course, again, he didn't deserve it. We do. And then he tells them that things are going to get worse, even possible to the point of death. All right, then in verse 4, which would be the last verse we're going to cover this morning, but we're going to flesh this out a little bit. He tells the people he's writing to, you have not yet resisted to the point of shedding blood in your striving against sin. You have not yet resisted it. So far things have not been too bad, but it seems like he is expecting that at least some of them are going to die. So in your notes, it says the author seems to warn them of approaching martyrdom for some. Some of you people are going to die. So the religious leaders of the Jews looked upon them, these people, as apostates and traitors. And as I think Hobie mentioned earlier today, or maybe Charles, one of y'all mentioned anyway, that their big enemies at the time were the Jews. And the Jews were their enemies because they looked upon them as traitors, apostates. All right, so here's a group of persecuted Christians. And evidently they go to church on Sunday because it seems from what the author says that he warns them not to forsake assembling themselves together. So evidently they were still assembling themselves together. So at least one time a week on Sunday, it appears that they were meeting, and possibly other times too. All right, now that's important. That's important to keep in mind that they are meeting, that they are having church, just like we do. All right, what does 13:13 and 14 tell us?
You mean 13:34?
34 and 35, yes.
That's Elaine, right?
Yeah, Elaine, yeah.
I just needed to hear the right numbers. A new commandment I give to you, that you love one another just as I have loved you. You also are to love one another. But this, by this, all people will know that you are my disciples, if you have love for one another.
All right. Let's look at this command that's fashioned by Jesus. He says, a new commandment I give to you. Now, it says that you love one another. There's nothing new in that. I mean, that's taught in the Old Testament. Here's the new part. That you love one another. excuse me. Lost my place here. Love one another, even as I have loved you, so that you also love one another. Jesus says, even as I have loved you. That's the new part. How did Jesus love us? Let's skip over to Alanda and her reading. 1 John 3:16 through 18.
Whereby perceive we the love of God, because he laid down his life for us, and we ought to lay down our lives for the brethren. But whosoever hath this world's good and seeth his brother have need, and shutteth up his bowels of compassion from him, how dwelleth the love of God in him? My little children, let us not love in word, neither in tongue, but in deed and in truth.
Okay, let's break this down a little bit. Jesus says, this is a new commandment I'm giving you, that you love one another just as I have loved you. And then the same author, John, in 1 John, states that we know love by this, that he laid down his life for us. Okay, Jesus laid his life down for us. That's how he loved us. He laid his life down, the ultimate sacrifice. And then he makes this startling statement. We ought to lay down our lives for the brethren. Joshua, if you want to read the passage that I gave you. you know I'd call on you when your glasses were off, right?
Yeah. This is John 15, verses 12 to 14. This is my commandment. You love one another as I have loved you. Greater love has no one than this, than to lay down one's life for his friends. You are my friends if you do whatever I've commanded you.
Okay, he says, greater love has no man than this, than to lay his life down for his friends. Jesus has commanded that we love one another even as he has loved us. Okay, so we are to be ready to lay our lives down for one another. Of course, we should be willing to lay our lives down for Jesus. Okay? And he's telling these Hebrews that some of them are going to be martyred, and they're meeting together on Sunday. Keep that in the back of your mind. Now, we, in this passage in 1 John 3, which Alanda read to us, in verse 16, he says that we ought to lay down our lives for the brethren. That's a tall order. I don't know if I'm there yet or not. But he says, but whoever has a, this seems kind of an out of the place statement at first reading. After he says you need to lay down your life for your brothers and sisters, he says, whoever has the world's goods and sees his brother in need and closes his heart against him, how does the love of God abide in him? Those statements don't seem to go together. But I think it's what John is saying here is that you need to learn to love in the little things first. You may not be ready to lay your life down, but you can get in practice for it. You can start training for it by helping your brothers out in need. So you can start training for it. John seems to believe, I know y'all can't lay your lives down for your brethren right now. You're not there. But you can start by loving your brothers and sisters, by just helping them out with what they need. In other words, you are meeting together on the Lord's Day. Of course, the first reason you're meeting together on the Lord's Day is what? Worship God, right? That's the main reason we're in here. But if I'm connecting all these statements together, we are told that when we meet on Sunday morning, we are to be in training on how to live and also how to die. We are learning how to lay our lives down for our brethren. We are in training for the ultimate sacrifice. And you can't do that unless you're meeting together. How many times were you told in Sunday school that when you were growing up that you're meeting here to learn to lay your life down for somebody? Well, I believe that martyrdom type passages that we read from John, that we read from Jesus, that we read from the author of Hebrews, that is another reason we have to meet together. If you can lay your life, think of the most irritating person you've ever seen here at Reedy River. The one that rubs you the wrong way completely.
I'm sorry.
And if not here, at any church you've ever been to. Are you ready to lay your life down for that person? If you're like me, the answer is a flat out no. Which shows me I've got work to do. So, brothers and sisters, when we meet here on the Lord's Day, we have work to do. Number one job is to worship God. But another very important job is to learn to love one another. Even to the point where you're willing to die for each other. So it's another reason that we need to meet. And here at Reedy River, the Lord's doing a great work for us. And He's blessed us. I think He's blessed us because we've been faithful in meeting, even when the circumstances have been less than ideal. But let's keep it going by doing what God wants us to do. Let's be in training to love one another the way we should. If you're like me, you got work to do. I know I have plenty. Okay, anybody have any comments on anything that we've gone over this morning?